of Sewin Township. Participating today in the Saginaw Valley College Oral History Project is Mr. Carl Rummel.
Present.
This tape is being recorded in Sewin, which is located in the thumb of Michigan on the shore of Saginaw Bay. It is a small town of 2,000 population, which serves an additional 2,000 residents in the surrounding rural area of Sewin Township. Participating today in the Saginaw Valley College Oral History Project is Mr. Arthur Rummel. Mr. Rummel has been involved in the retail business all his life. Art, how long have you been involved in this business of running a store?
Like we always did when we were 50 or 75 years ago, when you were old enough to work, you became involved whether it was a farm or whether it was your business. And that I can trace that back to the time my father had the store at Europe.
You want to tell us a little bit about your father?
Well, he originally came to Sewin around 1880 at the age of, I would say, around 16 or 17. And he with two other young men, and none of the three boys could talk either English or read or write English. And
what did they speak?
German. Nothing but. Mm-hmm. Nothing but the German.
So now, where is Gera?
That's 4 miles north of Franken.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And their employer, Mr. Henning, insisted that they arrange somehow with the school teacher here to give them lessons in English, which they did. And from that, after working at the lumber company there for several years, he got a job with John C. Lightning Company, who operated the general store at that time. And the work there meant everything from helping load boats on the river with slabs and staves and so on, going out in the lumber camp, what they call that now, to just to measure the logs. They had a certain name for that, I can't just recall it, I mentioned it before. And to mark the logs with their particular log mark that they put on the end of the logs. And from that, he gradually worked himself up to knowing more about the merchandising business. And the Lightning Company opened their general store at Kilmana, which is 6 miles east of Sewin. He was put in charge of that and became manager of that. And in possibly 5 or 8 years later, Lightning Company decided to sell their different stores, and he and another man with him, Albert Wolk, bought that store out there, and they operated it as a partnership until 1896.
Now, I don't think we mentioned your father's name, did we? Did we say what his first name?
My father's name was John Rummel.
John Rummel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, shortly after, around 1896, he learned of the store being up for sale at Gera, and Mr. Geyer owned it. And he went up there and they arranged to buy it. And we were at Gera from 1896 until 1904. And he sold the place in 1904. By the way, he also managed the elevator there for Brandon Harding Company at Saginaw at the same time.
Oh.
And in 1904, in the spring of 1904, we came to Sewin. And in the fall of 1904, he bought the building, which was operated at that, not the building, but the business, which was operated at that time by a Mr. Blumenthal.
Now, when you said we came to Sewin, who was,
well,
who all involved we? Who,
yeah.
who were all in the family?
Well,
that
was
time?
Myself and Anna, Mrs. Small, Carl, my brother, and Clara, Mrs. Everett.
And your parents?
And my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after we got here, Anna was married to Ernest Small, and he was with the firm until he died in 1915. And of course, everyone in the family pitched in those days because there was so much barter, eggs and butter and so many things that had to be taken care of. And the farmers would bring the eggs in baskets, even in bushel baskets. A lot of them brought them in that they used oats for a sort of a cushion that they could put more in there.
Oh.
And
they didn't have the cartons we have nowadays.
No. And I don't know why, but in those days, the people that bought the eggs from us, they never furnished us with the egg crates to ship until the end of the week or something like that. And I remember many, many times that Mother and I and the whole family stood there half the night to pack these out of the bushel baskets and into these crates. Well, then later on, the firms furnished them to us directly so that we could pack them right into these cases. Another thing that farmers used in those days is what they called a Humpty Dumpty case. They found 12 dozen. There was a, had more than 12 dozen eggs at a time. And we could use those cases again to put in their groceries. There was no such a thing as shopping bags in those days. Every farm woman or the men that came in, they either had their baskets that they bought from some of the Indians around Monacassee, and we had something to put their groceries in. Shopping bags were just unknown in those days. And of course we had people that don't know, I think there were some people that were selling cream, but that didn't come until later. And in the early part of the merchandising game, people, I can recall, and my father always said we had three different kinds of butter, good, bad, and indifferent. And that meant that the people weren't clean or so on. They simply didn't have the facilities to take care of this. They didn't know, of course, that you couldn't mix Monday's cream with Tuesday's cream and Wednesday's cream and get a good wad of butter out at the end of the month.
A sweet cream butter.
But, yeah, there were some people that did, but very few. And those were the people that had good basements and had deep wells that they could have cold water to chill this cream and get it cold enough, but they would churn a couple times a week.
Yes, because you're speaking of a time before refrigeration or any ice boxes anything.
So the others, and that's why I want to emphasize again, it wasn't that those people weren't clean, they just didn't have the facilities. So you'd come and they'd bring this butter in crocks, see? And the only way we could dispose of it, we had to sell it as what we called in those days as packing stock. I don't know what they did with it in Detroit. And we would take it in the way at 8, 10, 15 cents a pound. 9 times out of 10, we sold it for less than what we paid for it. And the man out of Saginaw, either Swift and Company or someone, would come once a week. And he would always have us take, sugar came in wooden barrels in those days. And we would take that wooden barrel and soak it in water, first on one end, then the other, and it became waterproof that way. And when he came, he would weigh the empty sugar barrel and get the weight of that, and then he would roll up his sleeves and he dumped his butter all in there, add a couple of big hunks of salt, and cover it with a burlap, and put a book over it and ship it over Detroit. I don't know what they did with it, but that was classified as packing stock, see?
That would be a barrel of butter.
A barrel of butter.
Well, then, actually, at that time, you were, in addition to a retail grocery store, you were also a wholesale.
No, not to that extent, because we bought all of this butter. We bought that. We almost had to buy it because the competitors were buying it, too, see? And the farmers used the eggs and their butter, and we even sold wood in those days, cordwood, oats, chicken feet, anything that came along, see, so that whatever, and potatoes. So whatever the farmer had to sell and offer to us, he would want to sell that to us in turn for goods that he would buy in exchange, see, so that...
But then if they brought too much of this, too many of these commodities in, like eggs or butter, that this is when you sold it to this man.
That's
in Detroit.
Right. That's right. Now we never had too much trouble getting rid of eggs. We sometimes had trouble getting rid of this butter. And like I've said before, I still don't know to this day what they ever did with it, because it really wasn't fit for human consumption. Maybe they had a way of rendering it so that they could purify it in some way that they could use it for baking or some such thing. But the value of it was small. I don't think we ever got over 10 cents a pound for it at any time.
But at that time, most people did have a small flock of chickens.
Oh, yes.
And so actually, would you say that you sold more eggs locally, or would you have shipped out?
No, we sold very, very few eggs locally, because right here in town, everybody had a flock of chickens of their own, just the same as they had any kind of a lot at all. They had a couple of pigs, and they'd have a cow or two, see?
Mm-hmm.
So there was no, I don't think that we sold 30 dozen of eggs a week. Well, I'm positive of that.
So actually,
retail.
At that time, in that type of thing, you were more of a handler.
That's right.
And what actually then did your did your business involve that you sold to the farmers or the people that came in to
buy the staples? Well, we sold everything from groceries and shoes and dry goods and clothing and paints and hardware and binder twine, rope and coffee. You name it, we had it.
Well, then it was termed a general store also.
General store, that's right. That's right.
And but the people brought the farm women brought their butter and eggs in potatoes in exchange.
That's right.
What about milk?
Well, milk we didn't handle any milk I think until just within the last 15 or 20 years that we sold milk.
Because at that time, as you said, a lot of people had their own cow.
That's right.
And then as that when that type of living began to disappear, then the milkman.
Yeah, I might just bring in here too. That was that was one reason we had no garbage problem, because everyone got rid of their kitchen scraps and everything else either to their pigs or to their cows or to their chicken. See, there was no garbage problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
All they had to do was buy a little grain extra with it to supplement that.
Well, what about the? Tell us a little bit about the packaging of.
Well, about one of the first things that I can remember that was packaged were the cereals that first came out when the Kellogg's Corn Flakes first came out, and then of course the coffee companies were I think some of the first, although some of the companies did have the bulk coffee also, because there were still some element of your trade that preferred the coffee bulk. Excuse me. They had an idea that there was something about that package that wasn't as good as the bulk, and they preferred the bulk. And then, of course, there was also a little difference in the price, but that was hardly enough to make them do it that way. But I can recall that we had bulk coffee that came in 200-pound drums. Now, those were made out of real heavy cardboard, and they had wood ends. And we would have that right out on the floor. This opened up so it showed the brand. One of them was Farmhouse, that I can recall. We got it out of Reed Murdoch, Chicago. And that was a big move with 25 cents a pound.
Now, what did you have to do to package this?
Well, that particular kind, we didn't pre-pack that ahead at all. We just scooped it out of there as they wanted it, a pound, 2 pounds, 3 pounds. And usually, and sometimes when we first started to do a little advertising, especially like this 25 cent, that 3 for $69 or something like that. And on some of those, we pre-packed maybe 4 or 5 packages, so as to have a few of them. But outside of that, about the only thing that we pre-packed ahead was 5 pounds sugar and 2 pound brown sugar, that is 5 pound granulated, 2 pound brown sugar and 2 pound powdered sugar. The father pre-packed that ahead. And,
but you would buy it in the barrel.
We'd buy it in the barrel, and the brown sugar came in the bulk. And I can recall so often that my father, in teaching some of the new help, he would always insist on it. He said, there's 16 ounces to the pound. We don't want to cheat anybody by giving them 15 and a half. But there's no one thinking for it if you give them 16 and a half ounces.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would always pride himself by being able to say, now look, I've had this 100-pound bag of brown sugar, and I've got 50. 2 pounds, and you can weigh each one of those separately, and each one of those is going to be 2 pounds. And it can be done. It takes a little extra time, but he was trying to do that more to impress the health, that he wanted accurate weights on both sides. Crackers were another thing that came in the bulk, and there was only one type of cracker in those days, and that was about the size of, in fact, it was a little bit smaller than our present Ritz that everybody knows about. And it wasn't a buttered cracker, it was just a plain cracker with just a little bit of salt on it, not as much as you have on any of these at the present time. And those came in barrels, I imagine they were around 50 pounds, and we had a glass case that sat up on top of the counter, which was about 3 by 3 and about 4 feet high, and we dumped them in there, and it would show these as we went down, we kept refilling them. And we got most of those, came out of the Schuss Company in Saginaw at that time. Later on, they sold the Sunshine. And the only other crackers we had besides that was your Graham crackers. And of course, they came in in 10 or 12 pound cardboard cartons. And the same thing they did with cookies. We had no packaged cookies for a long, long time.
And how were they?
Well, I can recall the Fig Bars, for instance. We bought, at first they came in 25 or 30 pound boxes. Later, when people got to know them and there was a bigger demand for them, several of the companies put them up in these regular sized garbage cans. You know, they would line the inside of this can with wax paper,
yes,
and put them in there. That gave them a good container, and by keeping the lid on there, they didn't dry out. And that was one way of packaging, and we could sell the container and get a little something out of it. But otherwise, it wasn't until, I wish I'd known the dates, but years ago, when cookies first came out, we only had maybe five or six kinds. There was the one that had a vanilla base and a marshmallow top with a coconut on it. And then, of course, your good old-fashioned coconut bar, that was one of the first ones.
They still sell coconut bars today.
And the ginger snap, of course, for that one.
Now, wasn't there a time where they had a cardboard square box
with a see-through? We had, when they furnished us with glass tops, on these, I think they were about a 12 by 12 container where these better cookies came in, or the higher priced ones. And for cheaper competitive cookies, they put them up in 25 or 30 pound boxes. And they were double this size, and they would furnish us with glass tops they were divided in the middle, so you could open them up from either side. And I can recall that later on, when they got a little bit more particular with the food inspection and so on, that sometimes we ran out of covers. We had too many cookies that we wanted to feature on the weekend, and we could have them out in the open. And of course, that wasn't allowed. And I can recall that at different times when we see the inspector coming down there, and we figured that was about the time he's coming. We quick take them and hide them in the drawers that we had in this one particular counter. That's another thing they had. They manufactured a counter at that time that had glass fronts in it, and the back was divided up into large drawers on the top, small drawers on the bottom. And you would have whatever item that was in that drawer. They had a window in the front that was separate from this drawer that you could fill.
Is this with more like a showcase?
Like a showcase. They could show whether that was oatmeal in there, whether it was brown sugar, or whatever that was in there. And the starches and the raisins and the prunes, and of course all of those things were involved.
And so this is mostly the way your staples were displayed in large counter like that. Okay, now when you said you had a general store, what were some of the other things you sold besides groceries? Did you have your store in different departments?
Yes, we have. There was a divider in the middle, and you could put your wall through there. And up on the one side, we had the Head Start. We had the groceries up against the east wall, and towards the south, we had the staple hardware like locks and bolts and padlocks and all those kind of things. And the nails we had on the floor, of course, all in the 100 pound kegs that came in. And on this center wall, I can recall, on the front end of it, we had the crockery, dishes and things of that kind, and in the rear half we had the tinware and the enamelware. I can still remember the wash boilers that we used to have. There was three different kinds of that. One was all tin, one had a copper bottom, and the other one was all copper. And of course all the...
I guess you could really sell a lot of those nowadays.
And of course there were your dippers and water pails and all kinds of water pails as far as that goes. There was galvanized and the enamel, and later on the aluminum. And on the opposite side of this wall is where we had our shoes. And that shoe shelf, that went all the way up to the ceiling, and we had one of these sliding ladders, rolling ladders, rather. And on the bottom of it, of course, there was the drawers for the put the heavier things in, like felt boots, when they were all in style in those days. And on the west wall, that's where we had the piece goods, as they call it, the dry goods, the games, calicoes, and what have you.
Well,
and underneath that, of course, there we have the different types of underwear and all of those things. And the other side, on the, what we call it the other side, We also had the men's shirts and the overalls and that, but that was back then, and that was separate from him. And of course, we sell a lot of overalls, union alls, and men's shirts, and red and blue handkerchiefs. And then later on, my father enlarged and he took on clothing. The first 10 or 15 years in business, we didn't handle men's clothing. But later, he took the room and enlarged that upstairs, and that was just for men's clothing. He had the west wall was all clothing racks with hangers that would pull out and have all these suits on it. So that covered all of that there. But it was simply a matter of, it was a little bit unhandy because the people had to go up that long flight of steps to get up there.
Now, how large was this store all together then, with all your different departments?
Well, at first it was 4,500, and then my father added 20 feet on the south end. That made it 80 by 120. I meant 40 by 120, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
And then, was the upper story used?
Well, that's another thing. The rear part of this was all used for storage because we had, in those days, we didn't have room for so many things on the shelf, and it meant that the factory had to do some filling up, as we call it, every day and so on. And we had an elevator in the rear room that we used going up and down. Now that we don't use the upstairs, about the only thing we have up there now is some extra display material or things of that type, but there's no merchandise up there at all. Because it's a case of in and out. Now, years ago, you'd buy ahead lots of times.
Mm-hmm.
And that same thing applied in the basement. There were, in the fall of the year, early fall, when these packers of peas and corn and peaches and all these things, they would have what they call an opening price. That meant that if you bought it as they packed it, they would ship it in one batch.
And you got this directly from the packer?
We got it directly from the packer, but it was
built. Not a wholesale grocery?
Most of the time it was built through the wholesale grocery because we weren't buying enough to get it through there. And there were these firms like Simon Brothers, Smart and Fox, and National Grocery Company at Saginaw Bay City that we bought these from. And we bought it in a larger quantity because the opening price was always cheaper than what it would be later on. And there were times there when we took inventory when we'd have 300 or 400 cases of canned goods on hand. And that same thing applied to syrups, Carol syrup, when they first started putting it in cans. Before that, it used to come in 50-gallon barrels. Nowadays you don't do it that way. You buy it from week to week. And those days you bought because you thought it was sort of a gamble. Some years you won, some years you lost on that. But some years you had to do it in order to make sure that the crops weren't so good. You had to make sure that you had enough of that particular quality or that particular brand that you were selling a lot of, you see.
Now, I think when we were talking earlier, when you were talking a little bit about your barter system, you told me how you kept books the ladies' grocery purchases.
Those people, I would say we had possibly 50 of our farmers that were, 40 or 50 of our farmers that were involved in that. And what we would do, we would give them what we call a small passbook. It was more or less just a memorandum book, you see. And if they had any charges made, we'd put that in the front end of the book there. And we had to itemize it all. If they bought 15 or 20 items, it was always itemized in there, the date, and then the total. And if at another time, if they would bring in butter or eggs or something like that, and they didn't trade out, like we call it, we'd take out the entire amount of this, then we would enter it as a credit on the rear of the book. You see, we would just give the date and the balance credit so much. And when it got to the end of the, towards the end of the year, along the end of October, the first part of November, they would bring these books in. And of course, we had to keep a record of that too, that we went into our day book first, and mind you, all of these items were itemized in there, and then they was carried in there as one total into each customer's ledger sheet, you see. And about October, November, they would bring these books in and say, add this up for me or figure it up. Because once in a while, they would buy something and they wouldn't have this book with them. Sometimes they would have a credit left and they wouldn't have the book with them, see. So we would have to add these missing debits and credits in there and then come up with a total. And I can remember that. I don't think that I ever, of all those that I've balanced out, I don't think I ever found a single one where we had more than $10 coming or where the farmer had more than $10 coming. That's as close as this barter system is being taken care of.
Well, don't you think part of it was too that the housewife or the farm lady pretty well knew the value of her butter or her eggs.
They were watching how much they were buying. They didn't want to go over that.
She didn't want to go over too much.
Then, of course, we have people in town, doctors and lawyers and some people that worked in the factory and so on, that we charged for the month. See? And I can recall there, too, that they would say at the end of the month, send me a statement. And we had what they called a food scap at that time. That was a sheet about 18 inches long.
You mean they charged all their groceries? They
charged all their groceries. And that all went in on, that all was itemized. And they would get this, and they would ask for an itemized statement at the end of the month. Well, it meant that you had to take a look at the ledger and say, May 1st. We'd look it up in the day book, and then we'd 8 or 10 items. Now, itemize all of those, and then maybe another one, May the 7th, and so, then maybe May the 12th or something like that, maybe the 8th, I weighed the heart. You had to give them that, and we'd come up with the balance. And I remember that.
So who kept track of all this bookkeeping?
I had to do most of it. But my father showed me how until I went to business college in Saginaw and got the better know-how on that. And then later on, of course, we cut out that monkey business, like we called it. And we simply made out a slip, and they signed for that. And that should have been, and that was up to them to keep that slip, see? Mm-hmm. And if it didn't, then we're still
you doing
that
same thing.
Yeah, we had to duplicate them with their signature on there, that was always too. Of course, on the wholesale end, for the first 25 or 30 years, too, we had a bills payable account there. And where we would enter up what we bought from the wholesaler and so on, and then lots of times we didn't have enough money to pay for it all at one time, and then the payment says they were made, the check number, and so on. But I think this goes back to since 1945 or so, we didn't have any bills payable account at all, because most of these bills were paid as they were delivered, or they were all within 10 days, and I argued that why put this in there, we simply wouldn't have to pay it within 10 days, and we simply charge it in as a purchase and be done with it, simplify the bookkeeping. It was in the family, and there was no question about what was left and so on.
Now, you stated just a few minutes ago that you went to business college. Now, when was this?
This was in about 1910. I went up there because I thought I should know a little something more about it. This was at Saginaw. They called it Miss Aldrich. And it was right downtown the Brewer Arcade. And really good, although I got a whole lot more bookkeeping experience when I was in the Army in 1917, 18. I was in, through Walter Gremmel, I got in the PX.
Oh.
And I was a non-commissioned officer in charge there under the commissioned officer, and I was in charge of bookkeeping. And of course, their bookkeeping system was entirely different than we used here at home, but the theory was the same, the principle was the same.
Well, do you think you got into the PX because of your connections with the grocery business, or with your connection with Walter Gremmel?
No, it helped me there, too. It helped me there, too, because they had up on the bulletin boards and all the different companies in the 338, and they had 8 or 10 applicants there, and I went out on it. I think possibly, to be fair about it, the supply officer of Company E, which was my company, was also the man that was put in charge of 338 Infantry PX, see? And Walter Gremmel was the vice sergeant of E Company. So it was just a combination of things, being in the right place at the right time.
Right.
See? And I always appreciated what he did for me, that he suggested that I take it. Of course, I had to be interviewed by the colonel, and that was all right. But I found that for to get us started, they sent out a CPA out of Detroit. Get us started on there, and I learned a lot of shortcuts from him. I knew the basic principle of bookkeeping, but he showed us a lot of shortcuts of what we could do in our duty. But it was a good experiment.
Now, how much education had you had, how much school education had you had before that time?
You should should have asked that.
Well, now, Mr. Rimmel.
It's okay. I'm not. I'm in a way. I'm.